Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 359.
This week on the podcast, the nation mourns the loss of John Lewis, while Marco Rubio learns that he can't tell any of his black colleagues apart.
Plus, Texas, of all places, is trying to become New York City.
And we live in a Southern Cone dictatorship, so maybe don't worry about election results anyway.
And if you're shocked you haven't yet had to go hungry, just wait till August.
Plus, Kanye West and all of his demons hold their first campaign rally.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
We live in a corona-riddled world.
We sure do.
Coming city, to you from certainly. A city that's just...
might soon be on full lockdown. It's on like 90% lockdown as it is anyway, but we're getting close. Garcetti hinted that we might just like be fully shut down again here.
Skyrocket to the top.
The nation, and we're not even the worst of it.
No, and I was looking at the LA Times list of, or maybe it's the New York Times has like a list of the number of cases in every locality and the per capita rate of positive cases in every municipality or in every sort of county and then every state. Yeah. And like some of these states that are doing next to nothing have much higher per capita rates than California and even than LA, the city, than you would guess.
Yeah.
Like, there are some, like, I think it was, like, Georgia or Florida, obviously, but, like, some of these other ones, yeah. Like, Alabama.
Well, and there's, like, new hotspots also, too. Like, right. I mean, like, something like 38 states are now, like, at their worst that they've been at. But, like, I think Idaho was spiking now, and it's probably with, like, 12 cases because there's only, like, six people that live there. But, like, right. You know, I mean, it's
still, not
great. It's, yeah.
Because also the number of hospital beds that you have is often in proportion to the number of people you have. So even if you don't have many people in your state, if you have many people with coronavirus and the number of hospitals that a state with no people in it would have, then you still have a problem on your hands.
That's right. Yeah. Like, and also Florida has like 49 hospitals right now that don't have ICU beds.
Great. Well, and they've been really killing it. They had their fifth day in a row of over 10,000 cases. So they're on their way to the top of the charts of coronavirus having.
Did you see what DeSanta said this week when he got asked about whether he was going to shut down gyms?
No, what'd he say?
He said, and he tried to give it in a way that like sounded it make made it sound like he was like a really thinking person and that like he'd really looked at the science here.
He's a performer.
About how if you're going to the gym, that's good because healthy people fare better. So he really wants people to keep going to the gym. Because if
you're
going
there,
to the gym...
share germs with other healthy people.
Right, but you're going to get healthy enough while you're there.
So that
the germs won't matter. Because if you're a healthy person, then you're... okay.
Just makes good sense, you know? It's just good scientific sense. We are every day hitting new and exciting milestones in terms of our national new case numbers that are alarming. And... we're getting, like, pretty close to hitting that Fauci 100,000 a day number in a way that we've been averaging something like over 70,000 a day.
Over 70,000.
And that's up about 50% or 200% from a couple weeks ago. Like,
yeah.
It's we not long ago, we're averaging more like 3,500 cases a day. So this is in a context where, like, most of Europe is averaging, like, under 400 new cases a day.
Yeah, exactly.
For nations,
like France,
for full
Italy,
nations.
Like Italy had like 128 cases, I think, like on average last week or something like that. Remember, we were all horrified when they were the first country to shut down.
Exactly. So, well, we're still talking about like, I know that none of these are countries that are as big as the U.S., but Germany has 60 million people and they're still averaging under 400 cases a day. So like, let's not pretend like we couldn't have done better.
Yeah.
And this is your, you know, weekly reminder that everything is scary and to wear a mask, I guess.
Please.
It's the least you can do. In more real news, in more current news, because this is going to be the news every week.
Until... I know. We struggled as we were putting together this podcast to sort of decide where we were going to put coronavirus. And we were like, let's just do it at the beginning. And
get it out of the way. Remind everyone things are terrible.
It's
going to
be weekly
news.
We're going to have to do it. Like, we don't have, doesn't have to be a featured story. Everything is terrible. We get it. You get it.
Yeah, exactly. You know? You get it. We get it. And... the only people that don't get it are the people in charge of solving it. So that is a crisis that we're dealing with on a rolling basis. In other news, John Lewis passed away this week.
Yeah.
And so did C.T. Vivian. It was not a good week for civil rights leaders.
No, on the same day. You know, and C.T. and both of that. And John Lewis, we knew, had been, you know, he's struggling with.
He'd been sick. He had pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And C.T. Vivian is much older than John Lewis. He was 95. So he died of being 95.
Right. Sure. That'll get you sometimes.
But, you know, I mean, that's a huge loss for the movement, which tragically is still ongoing. You know, the last his last public appearance was when he went to go see the Black Lives Matter mural in D.C. that had been, you know, painted there. And obviously that was, I think, a symbolic thing that he wanted to make sure that he did, I think, sort of to acknowledge that some of the work that he started, you know, 60 years ago is still ongoing.
Really ongoing, because there was a Twitter thread going around from a historian this week that was about the changes that were made at the very last minute to his famous speech at the March on Washington.
Yes.
He was the youngest speaker at the March on Washington.
Yeah, he was 23.
And so that all these like fancy older civil rights leaders are there, like MLK is there, you know, like the usual suspects. And they went over his speech right, and like the Archbishop of DC or someone was there, like they all went over his speech right before he went on and tried to kind of like tamp down some of the revolutionary talk. But a lot of the things that he's talking about in the speech, and especially the things that were cut out that had to do with the adversarial relationship between law enforcement and the Black community, and specifically how Black Americans felt like they were living in kind of like an occupied state, instead of feeling like they wished they were treated more fairly by, you know, it kind of got framed as a thing where we fear fascism from the outside because we see that it could come. And his initial words were very much like, we live in a fascist state ourselves, and like we need that to change. So there are a lot of really like prescient moments. I mean, they're not prescient because they were happening then too, but like moments that are especially resonant right now, where a lot of the changes that they were made to make the speech a little bit more politically palatable were around issues that we now understand to be as serious as what his initial words were saying. And so it's a really interesting read. I highly recommend looking into the speeches side by side, because there are a lot of ways, there are a lot of places online where you can go
and
do that.
Even some of the things that did end up in that speech, when you sort of like think about them in the context of the movement, and certainly about some of the things that like MLK was saying at the time, just, you know, I think most famously from that speech, and I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but it's something along the lines of like, we don't want change gradually, we want it now.
Right.
Was sort of really going against, I mean, of course, everybody participating in the movement wanted change immediately.
Right.
But a lot of them were sort of at least speaking, you know, publicly in acknowledging that it was going to be a long movement, and that they were okay with sort of like incremental changes along the way. And so even sort of like his most famous moment from that speech sort of really kind of, you could tell that he was really pushing, you know, felt like he was pushing harder. But of course, that was also probably at least in part his youth too.
Well, I was going to say, at the time, you can really like hear the, and this is something that I think is really like admirable about young activists that I think often gets dismissed because it complicates the lives of older advocates or activists. But I feel like young activists often are the ones who come in and say the thing and ask for the real thing and say, we don't want to just wait around for 50 years while we're half miserable. We want it now. And older activists, I think, because they've often been beaten back enough times that they're like, I guess we have to work with people or whatever. Are often really like, are often a lot more resistant to framing things in that way. I think one of the things that's really exciting about a couple of the movements that we have right now, not just Black Lives Matter as a movement that is a little bit more cross-generational in its radicalism, but the environmental movement is very young. The sort of more radical end of the environmental movement is very much 23-year-olds who are like, we don't have time for this bullshit. And I think that's an exciting place for a movement to be, because they come in and ask for things that people would never think to ask about who had been beaten back 300 times on whatever. And so I think, but you can see also, like, I think what's interesting about looking at those speeches side by side is you sort of see the ways in which sort of the movement kind of tamps itself down over time in a way that isn't all that constructive always. And it's sort of like, it's kind of exciting to see somebody who we've only ever known as an old man, like an old civil rights leader, who often, you know, because of course he was very frustrated about the constant reemergence of the issues that he was fighting, you know, about back in the 60s, could often sound very much like a grumpy old person who, like, had joined the ranks of the political establishment to some degree. To hear him at 23, you know, call for the revolution is, like, very exciting. So I recommend that anyway.
And well, and I think it's crazy to think of, you know, I think he sort of is most famous for, you know, the voting rights march that he led across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. He was 25 when he did that, you know, and he's, you know, there's been a sort of new push to, rename that bridge to his name, which I would say, sure, do. I think that he would probably be more happy if we passed the reauthorization of the voting rights.
Right.
Which has been sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk for, you know, for a year now.
Well, so, you might recall that the Voting Rights Act was gutted not by even your representatives, but by a Supreme Court decision that invalidated the most important part of it. So this is...
And sent it back to Congress, which the House of Representatives dealt with, failed. And the Senate has just been not choosing to not do anything.
Right. So this a nice way to honor John Lewis might be to at least do the bare minimum we can to
text
ensure
Mitch McConnell, call him, call your own senators that they are not being as full-throated about their support of doing that.
Well, and P.S.,
possible,
none of them are being full-throated enough.
Well, I know.
It doesn't and whoever your senators are, they're not currently being full-throated enough about that. That is one of those battles that's kind of gotten lost in the chaos of the Trump years, because this was something, I think they invalidated it back in 2015 or something.
Yeah, it was a while ago. I think the Democrats sort of like retook it up when they took back control of the House, which wasn't until 2018.
Right.
So it's found a little bit of new life recently just because.
Right. Yeah, because the House is looking for symbolic votes to cast. But like, this is something that should have never been allowed to expire or not expire, be invalidated in the first place. And is something that has actually has helped lead to the moment that we're in right now.
Right.
So it's sort of the bare minimum that we can do is to ensure that law as it was initially conceived of because it was necessary and continues to be necessary is able to be enacted. In any case. C.T. Vivian died.
Yeah, also died. He is not someone that I was as familiar with. I had certainly heard the name, but very... very interesting, and worked very much sort of, you know, hand in hand with Martin Luther King Jr. He was one of the founding members of the Nashville Christian Leadership Conference, which was like a satellite of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was MLK's organization. And he also started like this college readiness program to help children who had been kicked out of school for protesting racism. And that ultimately like became the model for Upward Bound, that was started by the Department of Education. And he was like awarded the Medal of Freedom by Obama in 2013. And so that's also a huge, you know, loss as well.
Yeah. Then of course we had the issue of both Marco Rubio and then later Dan Sullivan, even after Marco Rubio did it and got called out for it, posting pictures of themselves with Elijah Cummings to honor John Lewis's passing.
You guys.
Here's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of things. Here's the thing that makes this worse than you're even imagining. You, like, oftentimes, as a vaguely regular person who lives in the world, don't know what your representatives look like, even if you know their names.
Right.
So that is, like, already... I mean, I would say in the case of Elijah Cummings and John Lewis, because both of them were, like, incredibly famous members of Congress, like, you should also probably just have known what they look like anyway. But, like... Marco Rubio and Dan Sullivan work on the Hill. Like, these are colleagues of theirs.
Yes, right.
So it's not like this was just like an innocent, like, I can't tell two black people I don't know apart.
Right, presumably they have met both of
them.
They
have met these men.
Many a time. They're walking around work with them.
Well, I was going to say, like, I have seen both of them just walking around on the Hill. So these are people that are, like, in their head's airspace. Like, So this is not just, like, somebody who, like, doesn't know the difference between insert the name of any two people who look vaguely similar but not exactly alike. Like, these are their colleagues. Like,
yeah.
So aside from that being bizarre anyway, because A, Marco Rubio literally changed his profile picture to that as if he has any yes. claim to any sort of civil rights glory
I know.
At all. But also, like, this is, like, these are, like, people that were, like, in their lives in a real physical life sense. They were not theoretical concepts to Marco Rubio. Right. If you live in California, like, John Lewis is a theoretical concept to you. He's not, like, your friend. But that's not the case with Marco Rubio. And then Dan Sullivan did it after Marco Rubio did it and already had gotten called out for it. So that was crazy.
Yeah.
The best Twitter meme of yesterday was people tweeting pictures of Marco Rubio and insert the name of anyone and then mislabeling the person, including, like, there's one of, like, him walking with Kamala Harris and the caption is Marco Rubio giving Beyonce a tour of the Capitol. Like, it's just, like, a whole list of those things. Somebody tweeted a picture of a dirty sock and was, like, Marco Rubio meeting John Lewis. Or, like, some, you know, like, something like that. There's a lot of great tweets out there if you're looking for something to lift your spirits in the absence of good news. Trump did send out a very half-hearted tweet 14 hours after John Lewis's death because,
like,
he doesn't care.
It was, like, two sentences, like, sad for the loss, praying for his family. It was, like, a big nothing.
Also, I would contend you maybe don't want Donald Trump's condolences.
Probably not, but I mean, like, at least don't, you know, it's just, like, do nothing.
Well, no, he had to do, his problem as president is that he has to do something, and so his something tells a story that he doesn't want to have to tell.
Right.
But it only like twists the knife. Like he's just like a knife twister, like a life knife twister. in any case, elections.
Yeah. There were some on Tuesday.
Some exciting election runoffs this week.
Yeah.
We had
the runoff to take on Doug Jones, which was with Jeff Sessions trying to get back his old seat in Arkansas or Alabama, excuse me. Went down in flames to Tommy Tuberville, who's
like an embarrassing loss for a seat that was his just a few years ago.
Yeah.
It's over, Jeff Sessions.
I know. And what's crazy is he lost it because he, you know, wasn't Trumpy enough because of this whole sort of like Russia scandal and him recusing himself. He was the first person to endorse Trump in the Senate. I mean, he was like a ride or die.
Yeah. And then went to, like, gave up his seat to go work in the administration. Like, he's the person with simultaneously the most and least credibility in Trump world, which I think should teach us all an important thing about Trump world, which is that there is no loyalty in Trump world. So there's no reason to get involved with those guys.
Right.
It doesn't pay dividends.
And a person who was very, when we think back to his confirmation hearings,
I mean,
like, we were all hoping that there would be enough clear-minded people to vote against him because of all of the racist things that he has done over the years. So he certainly is racist enough for Alabama.
Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions III does not skimp on racism.
No, Jefferson.
I mean, Jefferson, sorry. What did I say? Oh, yeah. Jeffrey. Yeah. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III does not skimp on racism.
Yeah, no, not at all. So it was wild that he, like, went down in flames like he did. I mean, really just got slaughtered.
Yeah. It also, the whole thing gave Trump a chance to call Doug Jones a terrible senator who's just a super liberal puppet for Schumer and Pelosi with a bunch of weird capitalizations. He capitalized super and liberal. So he's excited about Tommy Tuberville.
He's been really going for him. I mean, this is a win for him because this, because
he's mad,
like,
at Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, exactly. What a world.
Speaking of Southern elections, there were some exciting progressive wins in Texas in a couple of runoffs as well.
Yeah.
So there are a bunch of runoffs going on right now, which is why you're hearing about them now and not back when Texas first voted. There are a couple of GOP-held suburban districts that had runoffs in their Democratic primaries. And currently, two of them have been called for the progressives. One is Michael McCall's seat, who this guy, Mike Siegel, who's a civil rights attorney, had been running against a physician named Pritesh Gandhi in the runoff, although there had been a third candidate in the race, Shannon Hutchinson, who had been sort of the D-trip pick. She was kind of the establishment favorite, but she didn't make it into the runoff, which is so typical of establishment candidates. But in any case, Gandhi had like a super PAC in the race for him that spent a huge amount of money on the race, more than, I think, $600,000 or so on the on the both the general and the runoff, but heavily outspent Mike Siegel and attacked him for being too progressive to win the general, and also called the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, which are both things that Siegel was standing for, like pie in the sky or something. Like, he was very critical of his platform. And Siegel, who actually had been the candidate in 2018 and won 47% of the vote, which is the only reason any of these idiots thought to run in the first place,
right,
won again.
And the Right, it was because he won 47% of the vote. And, you know, at the time, they didn't even think he was going to get 47% of the vote. Because they thought the district itself was out of reach.
Yeah.
So he now is sort of like looking at the fact that he was so close in 2018 and sort of like the further, you know, demographics changes that have even happened just in the last couple of years of movement in the suburbs. And it was like, hey, I can win the seat. But of course, as you said, the D trip is like, ooh, that's going to be a close one. We need some like boring ass, you know, moderate in there to like save us from the progressive. So this will be interesting to see how that pans out in the general, because it does seem like it's winnable and it's got a progressive candidate in it.
Well, and what was interesting is that Gandhi was the super PAC that was backing him is an environmental super PAC, but it's like a very vague middle ground environmental super PAC. Yeah, like John Hickenlooper is associated with it. John Hickenlooper is a big fracking guy. So like, I don't know what he's doing having an environmental super PAC in his life at all. Oh, and that's, Gandhi had called the Green New Deal fool's gold. That was his term, not pie in the sky. So the perception was that it was an environmental group that was backing him, even though he was coming out against strong environmental policy. And I think it helped that Siegel, because he was a civil rights attorney, had a record that became quite the boon once the BLM protests started. Because that was work he had been doing for years. And then he also, there was an interesting endorsement situation happening in this race, because Siegel had gotten endorsed by Sanders and Liz Warren and the Sunrise Movement and also the AFL-CIO in Texas, which is usually not endorsing along with the Sunrise Movement. Like, that's a pretty unusual combo. Yeah. And the Sunrise Movement had been, like, very involved in the race, which I think helped sort of temper some of the 314 action perception. But Kamala Harris endorsed his opponent, Gandhi, the one who was against the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and being supported by the fake environmental group 314 Action. So it was a chaos situation. And also it was Sandra Bland's district. So the BLM protests had like real resonance there, which I think also that was what I think Siegel had kind of a late surge in the polls that might have been related to that.
I think for Kamala Harris, though, like once you're both for and against Medicare for All at the same time, which Kamala Harris is, it then sort of opens you up to being able to endorse people who are also maybe
for
either
or
for or against Medicare for All.
Yeah, once you don't have any positions, it's really easy to make endorsements in any number of
races. Yeah, she can endorse whoever she wants.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird for her in the situation that she is in to endorse a different person than the Warren crew is endorsing.
I would agree.
I don't think that's a good look for her in this moment. I know it's a look that she has had before, but I don't think that it's a good look to go endorse the opponent to the progressives.
Yeah.
In any case, there's another district, which is, covers a lot of the suburbs outside Fort Worth and Dallas, that just had a that had another contested primary, and this woman, Candace Valenzuela, won it against what was the sort of ultimate in DCCC preference picks, because she was a retired, it was this woman, Kim Olson, a retired Air Force colonel. They love
the D-Trip only veterans. Will endorse you if you have been in the military. If you haven't,
if you're a conservative veteran,
you need to search elsewhere for an endorsement, because you're not getting it from them.
And Kim Olson was also much better funded at the beginning than Valenzuela, but and was leading by 11 points up until recently.
Right. Well, I think that's what she won. She won by that in the first round of voting.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Right. Before. Right. Yes. Olson won
the first round.
The first round, but didn't win enough to, like, you know, advance.
But then in the last
through a runoff
few months, she started getting accused of war profiteering. Actions related to war profiteering. And so the DCCC ended up stepping out of the race. And it also meant that Emily's List, which doesn't usually weigh in on races that are just between two pro-choice women, backed Valenzuela. But also backing Valenzuela was like a very bizarre collection of like the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, which is not always the height of progressivism. And then also she got endorsed by the Progressive Black Caucus. She got endorsed by the Progressive Caucus. Right. Like, she got endorsed by all of the caucuses.
Well, she would be the first Afro-Latina in Congress.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. And so it's actually, and it's an interesting race because the it's an open seat. The representative who has held the seat since 2004 is Kenny Marchant, and he is part of what they're now calling Texit, which is basically a bunch of Republicans that are not running again because the suburbs in Texas are moving blue at a pretty rapid rate. And so there is actually reason to think that these candidates might win. And I think there is also some precedent for it. There are a couple of seats where this happened in 2018, both in California, but there were a couple of Texas seats, including Siegel's seat, where a progressive candidate ended up running in a red district and performing relatively well, even if they didn't win. So we're waiting to see if that method is a success, a tactic that can lead to success, because that would mean that a lot of the kind of traditional knowledge about who's electable that Democrats kind of cling to about making sure that they run candidates in conservative districts that are very far to the right and sort of sound almost like Republicans is not necessarily sound logic in some of these places where the demographics are changing really rapidly, where the politics are changing pretty rapidly, and also where progressives can offer a clearer vision than some of these Democrats who are so moderate that they often can't offer much in the way of vision because they can't say anything because they're afraid of being caught being too progressive or conservative by everyone.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I mean, it's interesting on some level. You know, we're going to talk about Jamal Bowman here in just a second, which was a huge win, and I don't want to take anything away from that. On some level, picking up either of these in the fall would probably be a bigger deal in the sense that it would be a flip from a Republican district, which is just always better. But also, like, to your point, you know, I think we think about all of these sort of like big progressive, you know, kind of heroes, the AOCs of the world, and there's not enough of them yet anyway. But they're all sort of people who primaried a Democrat in a district that was always going to pick whoever the Democrat was.
Right.
So, you know, it's going to be important for the movement going forward to prove that we can win outside of a district that, like, any, you know, bozo Democrat can hold for decades at a time.
Well, and also that we can be at least as competitive as mainline Democrats in districts where Democrats often don't win. Like, I think a lot of what happens is when you have a district like this, it is Mike Siegel that showed that McCall's district was potentially flippable.
Right.
To then insist that he was too progressive to win the district when it was his showing that showed us that it was in play is kind of an insane logical lapse.
Well,
because
in the suburb,
for years, a Democrat has been running in that district and not beating or even placing in that election. Right. So,
who knows whether they've even been running?
Yeah, maybe they weren't even running people in those districts. Yeah. It's just like we sort of presume when a conservative Democrat doesn't win in a Republican district that was just how it had to be, and we don't often make that presumption when a progressive is running in those districts. But because of that, I think oftentimes we underplay how well progressives perform in districts like that, because the one thing that you can say about a progressive candidate is that they do often in a district, you know, in a fairly conservative or moderate district, they get attention.
Totally.
People do get excited to show up and vote for them. So that's...
And I think that this year there's a real good chance. I mean, I think that you can sort of like speak, you know, there's a larger conversation to be had about how progressives sort of like will perform in these districts sort of like, you know, year on year as to whether sort of these districts are ready for a progressive or whatever. But also, I think that this is a good year to test it out, I think.
Yeah.
Just because besides some of the demographic shifts, it was funny. I wrote this down actually, because right before we started doing this podcast, I was watching CNN and they were like doing like a whole sort of like poll rundown. And like, we know that Biden is sort of, at least in the polls, like blowing out, you know, Trump. And we've all seen those. But some of the more interesting things are when you like, you know, drill down into some of the like the other questions that they're asking when they're doing those polls, and they had the results for suburbs. They had polled people specifically in suburbs, and at this time in 2016, Hillary Clinton was leading Trump 41-39 in the suburbs, and right now Biden is leading 54-38.
the demographics of the suburbs are shifting. One thing that this article was saying is that it used to be that the suburbs in the Texas were particularly conservative. They didn't look like regular American suburbs. And basically what we're seeing now is that the suburbs in a lot of Texas cities are starting to look more like the suburbs elsewhere. They're starting to look more like traditional suburbs. They lean Democratic in a lot of places, or voters who lean Democratic are moving into them. So many from out of state. A lot of people are apparently moving to the Texas suburbs from out of state. So what we're also seeing is that places where we could really count on suburban voters to be mindlessly conservative to an extent, where it was part of the culture of the state, are starting to see shifts. And that's what I think we're seeing in these districts. But also, it is often progressives that show us that there's an opening in these kinds of places.
Sure.
That's what I think we can see from that Mike Siegel showing back in 2018, is it is a progressive who showed us that a break from the status quo was happening.
Yep.
So it's not...
And that's where the excitement is going to be, too.
That's where the excitement and attention is going to be. That's where the money is going to go. That's where groups like the Sunrise Movement are going to stake their claims. So there's going to be, an additional benefit in those districts, and for Democrats in general, to having exciting Democrats even in some of these districts where it's not a sure thing that they could win. And I hope that we don't decide to learn from this that progressives can't compete in these districts. I hope what we learn is that it's actually a pretty successful strategy to run exciting Democrats in districts where we don't necessarily have a guaranteed victory, because it gets turnout for everyone up and down the ballot up, which is going to.
Totally.
There were some other exciting Texas results. Travis County just picked a DA who was backed by DSA.
I know.
So that's something.
That's wild.
There was almost an upset in their Senate primary, too.
Much closer than anybody thought that was going to be.
They thought MJ Hager was just going to walk away from that, but Royce West and her were locked in a pretty close race for most of the ballot counting. She finally was declared the winner, so she's going to be who goes up against Cornyn. But, I mean, that was a pretty – hopefully that's a message to Hager that her electorate is not necessarily just who – people sort of presume it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably, I think that picking up a Senate win is the sort of next, it's like the great white whale for the progressives, I think.
Yeah.
Because the one thing that I will say about sort of the 2020, we've had some good wins. We've got the Bowman win. We've got some of these other ones, and we've talked, on multiple occasions about, various sort of pickups at state and local levels and things like that. But the DSCC really got all of their preferred candidates through their primaries.
It's hard at the state level.
It's hard at the state level. And also it's expensive. And the DSCC spends a lot of money. I mean, they spent a lot of money on behalf of Amy McGrath, and they pushed her out before there were even other people who had jumped in the race. I mean, she made a good chunk of her money before we even knew who Charles Booker was in that race. You know what I mean? And I would assume probably a similar thing happened in Texas. So it's harder to organize. It takes more money. But I want us to get one of those.
I know. I think it's going to have to start in a smaller state. I think the problem is that the high profile, it's, with House seats, that's proportionate. So you get as many House seats as you have people. And it is a little disproportionate because there are states who don't have enough people to have a House seat, and they get a House seat. But it's much more proportionate, which means there are many more representatives representing states, progressive states, where these kinds of victories are possible.
Yeah.
It's hard because the states with the affordable Senate seats are also states that are pretty reliably red. And so we're kind of at a disadvantage there. And the DSCC does not help, because in states where we could run progressives for statewide office, in part because, in some states it might be because they have no chance of winning. And that's a fine way to do it. Why not run a super progressive in some of these states where there's sort of a cultural kind of Republicanism that isn't going to allow someone with a Democratic identity to win anyway? Why not try to run someone who can shift the conversation a little bit there as a long-term strategy? I mean, that, I think, to me makes sense. That doesn't make sense to the DSCC because they want Wall Street Democrats to be elected. But I think the obstacles that we're up against at the Senate level are so numerous and so expensive that it's almost, it's not going to happen until the House is progressive enough that it can. Until there are enough voters whose own representative is progressive and can jump in and support some of these progressive candidates, it's not going to happen. Because we need like a mass of, because it usually the way it works is that your Senate, you want a senator to endorse you as someone who's running down ballot from them.
Right.
You don't, senators are not like, I hope that a lot of randos in my district will endorse me. I don't, they don't fucking care. So there has to be a critical mass of people down ballot that can endorse them all together, I think is what has to happen, which you, we're starting to see. I mean, that was what was exciting about the Charles Booker thing is we finally saw some of those people jump in and endorse. And that was, I think, a valuable learning experience because it really did give him visibility that almost led to a real showing in that race. So that's a longer game thing.
Yeah.
In any case, there are a couple of other places where we have progressives running in red districts, including there's one in Omaha and then there's one in Syracuse. And so hopefully, I think the one in Syracuse, is that Elise Stefanik's district?
I'm not sure.
That district needs to be flipped, by the way. If you live in Elise Stefanik's district, figure your life out right now. That woman, upstate New York, is heading blue. You can definitely get a Democrat elected in that district because Elise Stefanik was the closest thing to a Democrat that the Republicans had up until she went full Trump. And you could get her out of there. It would be so easy.
Yeah, do
and
that.
And just like everyone, use the Katie Porter model in these suburbs.
Right.
Katie Porter and Mike Levin also did this in California, but Katie Porter, I think, has done it more splashily because she actually is progressive. And Mike Levin's like pretty mediocre progressive. But Katie Porter walked into a district that was both changing, but also just like not the kind of Trumpy Republicans.
Had been red forever.
Had been red since the dawn of time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she not only went in there and ran as a progressive, but she has been representing them as a progressive. And she has been someone who's been fairly principled about her progressivism.
Freaking American heroes.
Exactly. Yeah. She is, I think, the only House candidate in Southern California that I'm like legitimately excited to go work for. You know? Like there are other people that I think are good, but I'm just sort of like, either you're in a district where you're safe and no one is challenging you, or you're in a district where I feel mediocre about everything that's happening in the entire situation. You know? In any case. So we also learned that Sarah Gideon is going to be the candidate, which we suspected, to take on Susan Collins. And in the process of learning that, we learned something horrifying. We've learned this genre of horrifying information before, specifically in the Mark Kirk, Tammy Duckworth race of whatever year that was.
Right. I learned it initially when HRC endorsed the other HRC, Hillary Rodham Clinton, which I was not happy about, but also like that was expected. Yeah. So I could acknowledge, at least to a degree at the time, that like they were never going to be endorsing Bernie Sanders. So like whatever, even if he was the clear better option on all of the issues that they care about.
Right. Right. So we're talking about the human rights campaign as opposed HRC. To Hillary Rodham Clinton, but they both go by HRC. And we have been longtime HRC truthers because obviously this is an area of interest.
Well, I was a longtime HRC donor until 2016.
Exactly. Brent had been donating to them for a long time. You had been like a monthly donor or something, hadn't you? I mean, you had been a regular donor.
Yes. Which I canceled and then sent a very strongly worded letter when I canceled.
Right.
And then have responded to like various emails over the years, just like, really, you know,
Brent
like
trolling HRC is my favorite thing like, that he does, you know, on a regular basis.
Karen style, just to make myself feel better. Everything I'm quite certain has gone unread by them, is fine, but it makes me feel good.
There are times that we understand that various organizations that deal with the civil rights of various people make medium questionable choices in general elections because that's life, of course.
Sure.
When you are an organization, though, that is calling yourself literally the Human Rights Campaign,
yes,
and you routinely make choices like, and this is where our rage comes in this time, endorsing Susan Collins since the beginning of time.
They've been endorsing Susan Collins since the year 2000 or 96. I can't remember. Yeah. It was whatever.
It was 96. It was early enough that she had had multiple reasonable Democratic opponents in that time.
Yes.
And HRC had been endorsing her.
And here's what I have to say, because I'm going to call their fucking bluff on this one. Because they are, I hate them, and I'm not going to let them off the hook on this one, because I can give them that Susan Collins has been easily the best Republican on all of the issues that they care about, right, to the point, even surprisingly so sometimes. I mean, she voted to get, you know, she voted to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. She voted against, you know, marriage amendment. She has been there for the votes. But the reason that they called her out specifically and said that they are changing their endorsement is because of her vote for Brett Kavanaugh. And while that sounds like a moral stance that you have just taken, I would like to call out her vote for John Roberts.
Yeah.
Her vote for Samuel Alito.
Right.
Her vote for Neil Gorsuch. Yeah. She has been voting for every conservative Supreme Court nominee since the beginning of days.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have voted for Clarence Thomas, but just wasn't there in time.
Right.
So, A, that is not a valid excuse to decide to endorse someone else. While I'm glad that they decided to endorse someone else, but they have just been doing the wrong thing for 25 years.
Well, and this
was, and I'm not gonna, like, what the fuck?
This is exactly what happened with the Mark Kirk Tammy Duckworth race. They had been endorsing Mark Kirk, and they endorsed him over Tammy Duckworth in that race, which is right. why it was notable to us.
And then had to unendorse him when he used a racial slur against her
right.
and her family.
And they had said the reason that they were endorsing him was because he was the best Republican on gay rights. But here was the right. thing. He was running against someone who was going to be significantly better on gay rights than him. It is one thing to decide that you are going to say, of the Republicans in the Senate, Susan Collins and Mark Kirk are the best on this issue we care about.
Sure.
It is another to endorse them over people who would be superior.
Yes.
And to also sort of use your, you know, they have a lot of big money donors. They're a well-connected organization. To use that money and that power and that platform to raise up the likes of Susan Collins and Mark Kirk over their better qualified opponents on the very issue that you talk about and that you are specifically there to work on as an electoral strategy. Like, it is not enough to just decide, like, look, should Republicans be better on LGBT issues? Yeah, everyone should be. like, what are we talking about here? But, I mean, they're not. As a group, they're not.
Right.
Members of the group are routinely asked to make votes that are detrimental to, and this is, I mean, HRC always has a problem because they don't care about any intersectional issue with LGBT issues. So they oftentimes,
that's the problem.
They don't give two shits about anyone who isn't
right.
very
like we were just talking about the Voting Rights Act, you
exactly.
know, like
they don't care
Supreme,
about that.
The Supreme Court that Susan Collins voted for,
right.
you know, was the one who gutted the Voting Rights Act, but HRC could give a shit.
Exactly. Right. And HRC has been called out time and again because for years they were just like horrendous on trans issues.
Totally.
So they're already a problematic organization who really we all understand to be only representing sort of like white,
right. rich white gay men.
However,
100%.
Even rich white gay men do not
could
benefit
have,
from
could
fucking
do better
Susan,
than
Collins.
Susan Collins.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you.
Like
right.
that is also that is still a group of people who does not need Mark Kirk and Susan Collins to be in Congress.
No, to be working on their behalf.
Exactly. So it's not serving the people that they purport to represent, which is not even everyone.
Right.
In any case.
There's
stop nothing,
giving your money to them. They're not doing anything good with
there
it.
There are like
by the
one
way.
Gajillion gay rights organizations in the world that are like
100,000
times superior.
They're all
there are
better.
Some, if you want to give your money to a mediocre one, there's other mediocre ones that just aren't as patently evil.
Right.
You know, I mean, they come, LGBT orgs come in all shapes and sizes. Some are medium awful and yet still not as awful as HRC. Some are great and those would be the ones maybe we would recommend to you. But, you know, use your best judgment. It's just like, this is like a line that maybe you should not cross.
Yeah, I'm with
you. As like
you.
A person who cares about things. Ugh. If that is you. If that's not you, do you know, why are you listening? In any case... we finally got an official call in the Engel Bowman primary. Jamal Bowman, sorry, has won officially.
Yeah.
Final call was, I think, 56 to 40.
Right.
So
that's what it was, I think, at the time that they decided that it was
at the
okay
time
to call.
That they made the call.
It could potentially change
it might
from
still
that,
change.
But I mean it.
But Bowman was leading by 16 points.
Yeah.
Engel conceded pretty soon after that.
Yeah.
But this is very exciting, you guys.
Yeah, it's exciting. And, you know, it's like one of those things. I know. We've said this on the podcast before because, like, it was one of those ones where it, like, seemed for all the world, like, in the weeks leading up to that, that this was going to happen. So it sort of, like, took away the excitement of, like, the AOC primary night where she's, right. like, getting shocked in a, you know,
right,
a
bar where there's, like, a video like, footage of her watching the results and, like, gasping.
Right. So this had less of that element to it, but it is just every single bit as important.
It is, and so satisfying.
Right.
So yeah. satisfying.
Potentially more satisfying considering the missteps toward the end of this race that sort of got Elliot Engel.
Yeah. Well,
you know, I mean, he may have lost anyway. I mean, this was already a race before,
no, I think
you know, some of this crap
happened
anyway.
This was a race
anyway,
before, but,
like, but
he really ushered in the
right.
raciness of it.
It felt more delightful to get rid of him yeah. than
well,
it
right,
did.
Because, well, also, I think it would have been bittersweet in the way that I think a lot of people felt like that Crowley victory was bittersweet, not because they weren't excited about AOC, but because there had been nothing essentially that separated him from other medium progressive fine Democrats. And so it seemed like such a bizarre thing to be celebrating him or celebrating his loss so aggressively. Right. And in this case, I think that would have been the same. I mean, Elliot Engel has been a pretty reliable progressive-ish voice in
right.
Congress for a long time. And so I think people would have, I mean, progressives like us would have been like over the moon about all of this.
Right.
But I think the rest of the city might not have understood so innately why it was time for Engel to go. And then I also think that there is another element of this that I know as a New Yorker that I think maybe people aren't thinking about because it's not sort of like the issue du jour of the moment. But that district was designed so that Elliot Engel could keep it, and the vote that was keeping him there was an Israel vote. And the fact that
well,
that is
shifting.
Well, that's
the most money at the end.
Yeah, AIPAC.
In his favor. Yeah.
And so that was, his district was designed for him, and it was designed to ensure that he was able to sort of like win by getting enough of the vote. There's sort of a Jewish community in that district and a number of districts in New York City that is like more dedicated to Israel than it is to what's going on in the U.S. They're like conservative Jewish communities in some of the outer boroughs. And Nadler has some of those neighborhoods also in his district that, you know, when you notice the shape of his district, there's this weird part that goes into the coast of Brooklyn. And that is a district that is also designed
to
keep him in there for that issue. But I have been looking forward to a time when New Yorkers who have slightly more progressive opinions about the Middle East could win in some of these
yeah.
districts, not the least of which because I want to be fairly represented if I ever move back there.
right,
but,
yeah, exactly.
But just because I think for a long time we were tolerating the most progressive members of the House being hawks on Israel. And I don't think that we should have to rely on a progressive movement that has incredibly hawkish policies on any specific issue. And
totally.
I think they're obviously, like, to accurately represent people in New York City, you have to take into account the fact that a quarter of New York City is Jewish, and that is
a vote
that wants their relatives in Israel to be safe and also for it to be safe to be Jewish. So I'm not talking about, like, suddenly we're just, like, dispensing with what Jewish voters need. But I think there has been this, like, weird sort of hold that some of the conservative elements of the Jewish community in New York have had on the local politics there and the national politics of the, you know, the congressional delegation. And I would like that to end because that has given cover to so many conservative Democrats doing so much bullshit in parts of the world that we have been at war with since the dawn of time and that are, you know, draining our military budget, are causing unnecessary strife to people in both the Middle East and in, you know, in Israel, I mean, and in the rest of the Middle East, and are in general not appropriate focuses for our foreign policy. And I sort of am happy to see the end of that era when it comes. Now let's move on to my home district.
Yes.
Has not been called yet. And it is crazy why.
Yeah, it's wild. Because they've thrown out like thousands of absentee ballots. Like one in five absentee
ballots
has been, they've been thrown out. Yeah.
I cannot wait to tell you guys why this is happening. Because, so they're in court because
Patel
the challenger, Maloney's challenger sued.
Maloney's challenger, Carolyn Maloney's, right.
But so in any case, here's what happened. So they were doing a lot of the vote by mail, as you do during a pandemic.
Sure.
And they sent out ballots to people and gave them prepaid envelopes to send their ballots back in so that there would not be a poll tax. And I guess didn't realize, which is so typical of them, that if you do a prepaid, a postage paid envelope, it doesn't get postmarked. And so they were expecting to be able to tell when those ballots had been cast by their postmark
date. Right,
because
they had to be postmarked by the election date.
Right.
So they could, they could come back in later, but they had to have a postmark of election day.
The instructions are that they that you have to postmark it by election day. But if you aren't postmarking things, if the post office doesn't postmark it, then what happens? So a bunch of ballots arrived after election day, as they do, were probably postmarked by election day, except no one has, there's no postmark. And the Board of Elections threw them out. Which you can't do if it was your fault that you didn't understand how the postal system works, as the very people that are responsible for getting the ballots to people via mail.
Right. And all of the candidates want them wanted. I mean, or of want them counted, obviously. I mean, you would. But I mean,
I would
also,
contend
that like,
this, counting those ballots is probably a bigger boon to Maloney than
to
anyone
Maloney.
Else.
I mean, the day of voting was actually closest. It was like 41.7 to 41 or something like that. It's the absentee ballots that are going to be in her favor because of where they're going to come from. And also just, you know, anybody who has sort of like more of a machine going. Which an incumbent probably would,
definitely
presumably,
does. Yeah,
anyway,
she definitely does. Yeah.
Is going to have been represented more in an absentee ballot. We've seen that in other races that have happened throughout the country.
Right, but this is like such a banana pants problem to be having. The Board of Elections basically catch 22'd a fifth of the electorate by sending them a ballot with instructions that would invalidate their ballot.
It's amazing.
I mean, who is working there? And also, they didn't hire any additional staff to read this new influx of ballots, by the way.
Well, that's
so
why it's still,
that's why
it's why
taking
we still
so long.
Haven't counted all of them. Yeah.
Because they were just like, oh, we don't have the budget. And I was like, well, it might be time to find the budget because...
Yeah, it's going to be time to find the budget because you're going to have to count them in November. And I don't want a month from, like, you know, we're going to bring you a story later about whether Trump's going to accept the results of the...
Exactly.
And it's like, and one way to have him not accept the results is if he's still hasn't gotten them 1 month after all the votes
exactly.
were supposed to have been tallied.
Well, and I would like to point out that if you are a person who is sitting around thinking that New York State probably has the right intentions or something, and so it's probably just a mix-up, I just want to point out that this is also voter suppression.
Well, and I mean, all you have to do is look at the fact that they didn't even want to have this primary in the first place,
well,
the presidential primary in the first place.
You
I
should
mean, have
already
have
known that
primaries,
this wasn't...
But, like, clearly they didn't have good intention. They tried to cancel the fucking thing.
But, like, even if you are a person who, despite all the available evidence that New York State is up to straight shenanigans where they, you know, their election laws are nuts, you can't vote ever. If your ballot gets wet, they can't count it. Like, I mean, a lot of crazy stuff goes on in the New York elections.
Right.
However, if you still, because you know it's a Democratic state, think that you should give them the benefit of the doubt. I am here to tell you
that
just because this is not an example specifically of not opening a polling place in a black neighborhood or something like that, this is still voter suppression if the state is conspiring or incompetenting themselves into making votes that are valid votes not count.
Yeah.
That's voter suppression. So that is an example of really, I would argue, extreme voter suppression in this case because it invalidated 1/5 of the ballots in my own neighborhood.
Yeah. Thousands and thousands.
A fifth
of
my neighbors did not have their ballot counted for their representation in Congress. And again, this is a Democratic district, so the Democrats going to win. So this is the only race in that district right now.
Yeah, right.
Like, have a heart, you know?
Right.
In any case.
Oh, man.
It doesn't matter anyway because we live in a fascist state and we don't have a government, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
There are like...
Well, we have a government. They're
that's true.
They're
fascists.
They're doing the wrong thing.
We found out this week that unidentified federal agents are literally like rounding people up, like abducting people from the streets of Portland who are not even necessarily protesting in the moment, like are just people that are recognized from protesting actions that have occurred at a different time.
Yeah. And we don't know where they're taking them.
Swept either. Into unmarked vans and just being taken to God knows
where. Yeah, they're rental cars.
Yeah, like fascist nightmare style. Like what happened, like disappearing people, like the Southern Cone. Like, remember when you learned about in history all of those dictatorships in the Southern Cone where people were disappeared and then the mothers had to go to the Plaza del Mayo and like protest to get their kids back every week. And it turned out they'd all been, you know, tortured in secret underground chambers or whatever. Yeah. Like
happening in Portland, Oregon.
That's happening in Portland, Oregon. And there's no promises that it doesn't come to your town, too, because Trump would like it to.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
Portland is doing a very Pacific Northwest thing and just continuing to protest. The Pacific Northwest.
I know.
God loves bless. To continue to protest. And so they were kind of on the edge this week of setting up their own autonomous zone, like Seattle had done, which I'm in favor of all the autonomous zones. So that was very exciting. And then federal agents sort of swept in. And the mayor, by the way, did not ask for federal assistance. So the federal government just sent a bunch of federal agents in to, like, go quell what was going on.
And they started abducting people. Because it's like all of their elected officials are Democrats. It's super Democrat. But, like, also, what, you know, home of the Proud Boys, I believe. You know, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's,
well, listen, it's a, you guys, the Pacific Northwest was founded as a white utopia intentionally. So there are some weird strains that go on there. They sort of accidentally turned into these very progressive cities, largely because they have this sort of like hippie vibe going on there.
Yeah.
But they were not very diverse for a very long time. And they also were founded in a sort of political tradition that was pretty explicitly racist. So there's some weird stuff that goes on there. In any case, now a bunch of Democrats in the House are sending a letter to the Trump administration, or to the DOJ, and also the Homeland Security Committee.
Also too, aren't they?
And I think the city is also suing.
Yeah.
Being like, hey dudes, you can't fucking do this. And so they're sort of trying to find out what exactly happened, because similar things were happening in D.C., where unidentified federal agents had taken their badges off and were starting to, you know, attack protesters for that weird photo op and other actions as well. So this is not just happening in Portland. So far, you know, the excitement of having unmarked cars round up protesters is something we learned had happened in Portland. But we also don't know if that's been happening in other places and we just haven't heard about it.
Right.
But the Portland police have, you know, been sort of overreacting to the situation. I declared the demonstrations a riot yesterday, and because some people,
well, they're having this weird thing too, where they're like in the places where they are protesting, also like at these parks and things. Like overnight, they'll put up a fence, and then like the next day, there will be a protest, and it'll get torn down. And then they come in the next night, and then they put up a fence, but they like reinforce it with, you know, like they're literally having like this insane tit for tat where they are like very clearly like instigating.
Yeah.
Like, and not necessarily directly, like, where they're, like, getting in fights with them, but they're just, like, doing things like that that are, like, making it, they're not helping. They're making matters worse.
They're making matters worse,
the police are the agitators.
Yeah, which, if you have been to a protest in the George Floyd era, then you also know that that's the case from personal experience. The authority that they suspect that the Trump administration is doing this under is from an executive order that Trump issued on June 26th that was to assist with the protection of monuments. That was when he was back being angry.
Well, that's why I think like they're like doing this sort of like putting these fences up around the parks.
Exactly. To theoretically protect monuments.
Right.
But this is not actually an appropriate use of that authority. And the fact that the DOJ is going along with it when it is pretty directly interfering with the First Amendment rights of the protesters.
But what does the DOJ care about those?
Well,
First Amendment rights.
They don't care. But I mean, just to be clear, like, this is actual fascist activity. It's not like a fun overstep of the Trump administration where you can just be like, ugh, that guy. Like, this is like a time that they are taking actions that are like consistent with authoritarian governments that have resulted in huge human rights abuses. So this is like a thing to take seriously, and also to like, I mean, here's the thing. It's nice that Nadler and Benny Thompson and Carolyn Maloney sent a letter to the White House being like, you guys can't do this. So that feels great for the people of Manhattan whose representatives those are, and then Benny Thompson's reps. Like, this is something, though, that like part of why you have representatives is to ensure that you have some protection against this kind of behavior from one branch of government. And we don't have any protection in the courts right now. But, like, you should assume that whether or not you understand how they're supposed to do it, it is your congressmen and senators' responsibility to call out this behavior and protect you from it.
Yeah.
It is that branch of government is the only thing left. And so, like, if your representatives are not really distinctly helping solve this problem, then you should be encouraging them to do that.
100%.
Because this really is, I mean, we say this all the time, because there's been a lot of tipping points to authoritarianism with this guy. But like, this is like a pretty overt one that I think we should not sort of be able to brush under the rug as like, you know, one of the many problems with this administration. This is a pretty, like, specific kind of problem that is consistent with a kind of behavior that is actually unconstitutional in a pretty specific and clear way. So let's cut this out.
Yeah, for sure.
Of course, this is it's part of a plan.
Right. This is part of the, you know, this is the story that we just mentioned about Trump not accepting the results of the election in November because he was asked about it in this wild interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News, by the way. I recommend at least watching the clips of it because there's some other wacky moments where, like, Chris Wallace, like, presents him with a graph of, like, coronavirus, like, showing how where it was, like, in mid-June and where it was now, and, like, Trump sort of, like, trying to pretend like he's not looking at the thing that he's looking at. I mean, it's a whole mood, this interview. But Wallace asked Trump if he was a good loser. The president obviously said no, because of course he's not.
Yeah.
And then Wallace said, but are you gracious? And then Trump said, you don't know until you see. It depends. I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do. Mm. And then after he suggested that he might not accept the results, he said, I'll have to see.
Yeah.
That's not great.
Also predictable.
Predictable. Another reason to staff up to count those ballots.
Like, yes. Also, another thing I think we can do is we've got to start working on a plan B where Donald Trump doesn't want the job.
Well, I don't think that he does, which because is he hates what's being making the president. This whole it's thing awful. Weird. Yeah.
Being the president sucks, you guys.
This is one thing I will say. I think that there are a lot of I would hope that he wouldn't do that because I feel like there would be a big chunk of his base that would sort of like go along for the ride with him thinking that the election had been rigged. I do think, though, that would finally be, you know, we sort of talk a lot about on this podcast and just sort of like in the world as to like what would finally be the thing that would like get the rest of the elected Republicans to sort of like denounce the behavior of this guy. I don't think that, like, he would find any cover with Senate Republicans or Senate, maybe some, like, rogue congressional Republicans who are sort of, like, far-right wing nuts. I think that he would ultimately be escorted out of the White House. It would suck if that would be what would have to happen.
It'd be a very stressful 2 weeks.
Because the repercussions of that happening, I think, would sort of be felt for a while, like, in the country from his supporters. So, you know, you sort of hope that he doesn't do that. But, like, I'm not super worried about whether, like, we're going to get stuck with him sort of, like, occupying the White House because, like, that's not going to happen, I don't think.
I feel like the kinds of repercussions that we will feel from him doing that are not worth us having to go through that with 100%. A man who is so inceptionable.
Oh, yeah.
That's like, I think this whole time we should have been focused exclusively on making him not want the job. We should have had a lot of plans going. One should have been everyone talking about how the best people they know in the whole world wouldn't want to be president.
Right.
The smartest people would never want to be president. The best people would never want. Like, that should have been a refrain we started the moment he took the job. That nobody who people respect would ever want to be the president.
I honestly think I think he's acting like he doesn't want it in the way that he's dealing with some things, but like I think he's acting very specifically in a way that he is trying to lose. The other thing that I found
he's
really
acting
interesting
out.
About
he's just acting well, out like he's a
acting
toddler.
Out well, he's acting out like a toddler, but also one of the other things in that that new story I was watching on CNN where they were sort of like going over all the polls, they were talking about who would be the best candidate to handle the coronavirus. And Biden was winning by 20 something odd points. Yeah. And that was also everyone's number one issue right now, because of course it's like the thing at the top of everyone's mind.
Yeah.
He is not acting like he's not doing the things that someone who was trying to win an election would do. Because if that was everyone's big issue and you were losing so bigly on that one issue, then you would do something other than deny that it's happened.
Well, I think part of the issue, though, is that he only operates on instinct, and I don't think his instincts are leading him in the right direction.
Well,
so
this
I
is
think
an
part
instance...
of it is he doesn't know what he needs to do to act like he wants the job, and so he is just doing what he does. And
well,
I think
this
is just like an instance where that he might be calling everyone's bluff. But he's called our bluff before, and we've sat back and done nothing, so who knows?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think in this instance, and I think this is why he's having trouble here, is because he's not one who sort of like cares about good policy. But I think, you know, we're about to talk about policy right now. And this is an instance where the thing that would get him out of that 20-point hole to Biden, this is, you know, there's that saying that, you know, good policy isn't always good politics, you know. Right. This is an instance for him where good policy would be good politics.
Yeah.
And thinking
really the
of
only
good
politics.
The only politics. And thinking of good policy is not what he is up to.
Yeah. Speaking of good politics, I have an observation about the presidential race that I want to make about his opponent. Because I've been also seeing a lot of sort of chatter this week on the interwebs and amongst people I know about why progressives are not just like, because we know that Biden is going to be the candidate and we know that, you know, this is sort of the race that we have now. Why you're not seeing like 100% of progressives just like full throated out there for Biden right now? Because why not get in there early? And we've explained in depth on this podcast why early is not always best in a race situation, because campaigns have oftentimes face unexpected roadblocks that make everyone look stupid if they have not, if they have just sort of like preemptively declared that someone who's not been vetted is the best choice. But also, I want to point out to that mentality, because I think it's something that is that people are getting drawn into because they're nervous, that campaigning is a process, and that progressives are the people who are best positioned to understand where progressive voters find credibility and where they find their excitement. And that the idea of just assuming that progressives would just out and endorse Biden and that would be done with it, and then suddenly be tied to a platform they don't agree with,
right,
when they're still engaged in the process of not just finding what those progressive voters will be able to latch onto, but also what the campaign is willing to give,
right,
is that would be criminal in the progressive movement to do that.
Totally.
That would be considered criminal. You'd be a sellout and you would not be welcomed back into progressive circles. Yeah. So like, I don't think that's good politics. I don't think that's good campaign. It's not a good campaign strategy. And I think the thing that we learned with the Clinton era is that getting reliable voters to the polls for Clinton is not the same thing as getting, you know, as getting the sort of layer of voters that they bring with them to the polls. And that you don't actually want progressives to endorse Joe Biden right now. You don't want full party unity, because you're going to end up turning off everyone who can't get on board with the Biden platform, which is almost everyone, by the way. So like, what you need is a process by which those people are able to feel comfortable voting for Joe Biden. And he hasn't yet engaged in that process, but he has to be shown, he has to be asked to. I think a lot of the time we blame individual voters for not showing up and give a free pass to campaigns that completely dispensed with their votes. I think we did that with Gore. We did that with Kerry. We did it all the time with Clinton, where we constantly blame voters for not showing up for them, but don't take into account that the real responsibility that the campaign had was to get those voters to the polls. That was what their job was. It's not my job to go and vote for Joe Biden, but it is their job to ask for my vote. So I think we're still in a part of the process where we have to get the Biden campaign to ask for the votes of the kind of people that we can't personally reach, but vote like us.
Well, and I think
we're not at that point yet.
I agree. And I also think that there's this real misconception on people's parts who sort of like aren't in the progressive movement, that like, just because I am still sort of like pushing Biden and sort of like am out there sort of like saying, no, I want him to take this position, or I want to be a part of a movement that is going to like push him in a certain direction, that also means that like, we're not going to vote for him.
Or also don't understand how important this moment is.
Or don't understand how important this moment is.
I would think
of
it.
You know, I have to explain to people all the time that like, when I'm sort of like ragging on Biden, that I also, you know, I don't know who I'm going to vote for, but like, there's a big part of me, a part enough, big enough that I, you know, will probably force me into voting for him, that sort of feels good about voting for the person who is going to be the person who finally gets this asshole out of office. I think there's a lot of people on the left that think that way. Not all of us. You might not even think that way. But like, I think that it is okay to be like, you know, not necessarily on board with who Joe Biden is as a candidate, but also sort of like acknowledge that maybe you're going to vote for him. Like, I think that, and people don't understand that. Like,
well, and that's,
like
I also,
a lot of my moderate friends are like, how dare you say something mean about him? And I was like, well, I'm going to say something mean about him and then also maybe vote for him. So settle down.
Also, I think though, there's just like the process of getting progressive voters on board with Biden has to involve admitting why he's such a shit candidate.
Totally.
Or they will not show up. Like, I think the idea that you think we're all just going to unified go and vote for Joe Biden is right. lunacy.
Right.
If you want progressives to show up for him, you have to let them ourselves. Be in their you have to let them be right. in their process.
Yeah.
And I think I'm just sort of like struggling with how we go through this again and again and again in every presidential year and usually lose terribly. And right. then don't learn this lesson. First of all, don't learn the lesson that some voters have actual like priorities in the race that are incredibly important to them. And it is incredibly yeah. heartbreaking to watch a candidate who won't take up those priorities be their only yeah. choice left. And that is a mourning process that you have to let people go through in order for yeah. them to do the work. But also, first of all, by having the candidate be someone like Biden, you give up a full-throated endorsement from someone like me. So that's right. the choice that you make. And that's yeah. that may be the choice that you're willing to make. But like, you have to understand that in having him be the candidate, you can't then complain when I'm not just like on board with no reservations and yeah. or not on board with no reservations and also not just like tweeting about Joe Biden all day. Like, yeah. that's something you've given up by right. having Joe Biden be the candidate in the first place. There were candidates yeah. who I find flawed who you wouldn't have had to give that up from me for.
Right.
But he's one of them. So sorry about it. You knew that going in. right. But also, you have to understand the thought process by which a progressive voter has to come to the Biden movement is one where they are having to vote affirmatively for 4 years of misery on their own behalf because they're going to have to constantly be in his ear. And yep. they're going to have to constantly feel powerless, and they're going to have to constantly feel like you're not listening, and they're going to have to constantly feel like all of the feelings that we have right now as Democrats are going to continue for progressives. And they're voting, you're asking them to vote affirmatively for that feeling. And so yep. you have to kind of like let them go through their process and also yep. understand why the process actually doesn't get shortened if you just demand that they declare
right, it was, you're not helping.
Loyalty to Joe Biden. That's not the process right. where, like, if you just ask them to, like, give up all their credibility on the issues they care about the most in order to endorse someone who doesn't support any of them just because he's not Donald Trump, then you don't understand how progressives vote.
Right, exactly.
So, like,
and I think that they don't anyway.
And I think they don't. I think that's been the problem on the sort of disconnected left for a long time is the a misunderstanding 100%. About where some of those votes, and also where the activism that they ask for from people like us in an election year can be found, like where yep. they can expect it from us, because yep. you don't get to twist the arms of people who work on issue related, you know, on policy related stuff. You don't get to just decide that they just sort of like have an open-ended endorsement of your candidate in fucking July. Just because you asked for it, you sort of have to first let them engage with the campaign in a way that is sometimes adversarial because it allows yeah. the campaign to know where their voters can be found and asks the campaign to find those voters, which oftentimes the campaign in candidates like Biden's case refuses to do. That would be maybe yeah. a place to go work on your own people. Yeah. But also you just like the process is the process, and getting people's endorsements early doesn't always benefit the process.
Yep.
It means a lot more to allow progressives to sort of openly go through their process so that other progressives can find a similar process for themselves than it does to insist on absolute loyalty starting in July when the convention hasn't happened yet. There's no running mate yet. There's no, yep. you know, the information that you would be, because it's going to be really bad for the progressives that have already endorsed Biden if he picks a conservative running mate.
Totally.
They're going to have lost credibility in their own movement that is going to affect yep. their lives in dangerous ways, and also your lives, because they're working on issues that are important to everyone.
Yep.
And so you just have to deal with yourself.
Yep.
Is all I'm saying. I'm just saying, I've been getting a lot of sort of indirect lectures this week about this.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And it was
about
on
how
my
you
mind.
Just need to get on board.
Right. Just sort of frustrations that I'm not getting on board. And I actually think it is more productive for the process if I'm not on board right now, you know, if I'm still allowed to engage with my hesitations right now, I think that actually does them more good than me jumping on board and then doing literally the bare minimum to get Joe Biden elected because I don't fucking like the guy. Right. Yeah, wouldn't exactly. they rather I can find a way to feel okay about his candidacy?
Right.
And if they can't provide me that way, then that is a failing on their part because their job is to find a way. So.
Yep.
And I, by the way, I stand in for many other voters. It's not just me personally.
Oh, yeah,
it's the idea that there are many voters like me.
Yeah.
And while I can always be trusted to come to the polls, not all of those people can be trusted to show up.
Right.
So in any case.
Exactly.
Might not matter anyway. And we might starve to death before November 3rd.
Yeah, exactly. Because the extended unemployment insurance ends. When Congress first passed the CARES Act, which was way back in March, they boosted those weekly unemployment benefits to like $600 additional on top of what you were getting for unemployment. And those were in place until July 31st, which if you're looking at your calendar, you will see is coming up very soon.
Coming up.
So, yes. And the other main thing that was in that bill, there were a lot of things. You know, there were a lot of small business loans. There were, you know, the PPP. There was all of that stuff. But the main things that were in that was that unemployment insurance and then also those $1,200 payments. There was almost $270 billion sent out in $1,200 payments to like 160 million people. As this has drawn on, people are sort of finally starting to acknowledge that, A, we're going to have to do something about extending unemployment insurance, and B, $1,200 wasn't enough. We knew that some time ago. I mean, I think there was like a poll in April that found that like they polled 2,200 people who had received their stimulus check, and 74% of them half had spent it in the first 2 weeks and 74% had expected to spend it in 4 weeks, so within the month.
I spent it 2 weeks before I got it because I had to pay rent before I had received anything.
Well, and that's the thing. And like, I think we may have mentioned this on the podcast last week. I can't remember. But, you know, you're seeing that sort of, you know, that poll was taken in April, but you're seeing that the fact that that has been spent already sort of like borne out in the numbers because last month was actually the month that the most amount of people missed their housing payment, whether it was rent or mortgage. It was actually the month of June was worse than both May and April and March, which maybe seems counterintuitive, but that is because
people are running out of money.
People got a little bit of money up front, and while it wasn't enough, it was enough to sort of like push off, you know, for economic problems sort of like into the future, and that future is now.
Yeah.
So we are now finally starting to hear reports that Congress is going to go back into looking at some sort of bill this week, like McConnell, Mnuchin, Schumer, and at least Pelosi. She probably already feels like she did her duty because she already passed something. We talked about all of the reasons why we didn't like the thing that she passed. It's probably going to end up being infinitely better than what they end up passing.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like McConnell's going to be writing this bill himself, maybe.
Yeah.
But we're going to be getting something here.
Right. What we might not be getting is the same unemployment benefits that we were getting, because nothing has pissed the Republicans off more than the idea that some people made more money on unemployment than not, even though there were no jobs to go to. So it's not like there were people turning away work because of the glories of their unemployment benefits. The reason that we paid them that money was because there's no job, even if they want to work, to go to.
Exactly.
And many of their jobs had gone away temporarily, theoretically, except then we fully mismanaged the crisis and now many of them have gone away permanently. But they were so angry, even though, by the way, just over $600 a week is not big money. I don't know if you have noticed what it costs to rent a place and buy some food, but it is just about that much. So it's not like people were rolling in big money. And also, you want, in a capitalist economy that we in an oligarchic capitalist economy, you want people to have money in their pockets because that's how they buy the stuff that you, I mean, rich person, make money on. You don't want to means test they're talking about means testing the unemployment benefits. They're talking about decreasing them. They're also, like, I want to point out that, like, because of shenanigans, a lot of people who are sort of most on the edge because they already don't earn consistent income were just barely making ends meet under those payments, because if you are somebody who gets both W-2 and 1099 income, they only counted your W-2 income and then they refused to pay you out for any of the income that you had lost as an independent contractor. So, like, the whole thing is craziness.
Right. So basically what they're planning now, at least what Mnuchin said, is that the unemployment payments in this next package are not going to total 100% or more than 100% of what you were already making. So basically you're only going to be getting what you were previously making.
Right.
Now, for reasons that we have also talked about on this podcast, have some issues with that $600 a week also. I don't think that it was necessarily a good plan, but it was a plan and it was giving people money. So it was sort of like doing the things that it was supposed to do.
Right.
I understand now that we are in deep enough on that, that you can't just sort of like pull the rug out from underneath people when you're not supplying some sort of other funding. You know, this is why we needed to be giving no strings $2,000 checks or $1,500 checks or whatever number we wanted to come up with a month on top of sort of like whatever our regular unemployment already was. So we weren't trying to do this sort of like weird system where there's like $1,200 check and there's, you know, this amount of unemployment that can last for this long. I mean, it was a dumb system that they came up with, but it was the system and we're in it. So to sort of now just go back and look and say, oh, we're going to pull, you know, $2,400 a month from you and then also only send you probably one more check that also could, it sounds like, could potentially be less than $1,200. And it also sounds very much as though they are going to decrease the amount of people that they are going to give that to. They're you know, because previously it was like if you made up to $75,000, then you got $1,200. But then if you were a family, then you got this much. And each dependent got this much. It sounds like they're going to sort of like shrink all of that. So they're going to send that money to less people and then also pull out that unemployment. So it's like they're not going to be – they're going to do something that is better than having it run out permanently, but they're going to not do anything that's really worth a damn.
And this is, by the way, I mean, we're already about to hit eviction city. This is
for sure
going to only make that problem worse.
Yeah.
Because, again, no one's costs were suspended during any of this. So the reason people need cash is because they have costs to living. We have a president who won't admit that we're actually in a worse health crisis than we were when they started making these payments.
Yeah.
And also, we have a system that doesn't actually pay out for much of the kinds of work that people actually do to get by in an economy where there are very few protections for anyone and everyone's working as a contractor. And the kinds of jobs that unemployment is set up to protect are not the kinds of jobs that most Americans have right now. So, and wages were already depressed. So to have a system where people's full wages are not being rewarded is going to be problematic. Like all of this is going to be problematic. They are going to only drive states further into crisis with them because we're going to have a problem in high cost states where when this $600 runs out, but that $600 is not enough to pay your bills here. And you already are in those high cost states more likely to be in one of these weird employment situations.
And you're
going to
get what, one $1,200 check if you make
$50,000, pay 1 month of rent in a one bedroom apartment in any of those states.
Right.
And then on top of that, you are going to see state budgets decreasing. So assistance is going to be diminished for people that need it the most. I mean, you're just going to see a never ending array of crises break out in these places, which I think is what Trump wants, because he wants to then say America's in chaos and they need me again. The problem is it's going to be his fault.
Right. And, you know, assuming that the Democrats and Republicans can come to some sort of consensus on what the unemployment looks like and come to some sort of consensus on what means testing they're going to do for this $1,200 check or whatever amount that it is for, that only covers sort of like those two big things. Like, what about additional funds for, are they going to have more money for small business loans? Are they going to have more money for hospitals? Are they going to have, you know, the HEROES Act had a bunch of money for state and local governments, which they desperately need. Is this going to have that in there? You know, Trump has sort of pushed back on whether he thinks that that's even a good idea. Also, there's been a lot of talk about like whether they're going to include money for testing and contact tracers in there. And it's not like there's a report that came out this weekend that the Trump administration himself is pushing back on like doing more testing. And that's just because he thinks that that's creating cases. That it's the testing that is the problem. So there's a lot of stuff to work out here, and to think that they're going to have any of it worked out by July 31st seems real crazy.
I once again go back to the overwhelming logic of, in a crisis like this, just putting money in people's pockets. We're not in a normal situation where we can blame people for being too lazy to work. We're not in a normal situation where we can expect that people have the option to do that, even if they are willing to work 16 hours a day for $2.50 an hour. There's not the option to do that. So I don't, like, the way that you keep an economy afloat in a situation like that is you just hand everyone money so that they can continue to buy the things that keep the rest of the economy going. That they, you know, because if you don't have money to buy food and you therefore stop buying bread, then bread factories also have to close. And currently those people at least have jobs. So you want everyone to have some money to spend.
Yeah.
The fact that we are so resistant to people having money they didn't quote unquote earn in a system that constantly exploits us out of money that we did earn, by the way.
Totally.
You know, in a system that has legalized our bosses exploiting that money out of our very hands.
Yep.
Is so bananas to me because it's actually what's going to keep the rich rich to do that. Handing money to every American is what keeps rich people rich in this moment.
Yes. Yeah.
The economy falls apart. They're the ones whose money is all in investments and in all of this very risky, in risky markets. You know, like my money goes every week or every month. It just goes to my landlord and then goes to the grocery store and goes to my health insurer. But it's not, if the stock market fully drops out, that's not where the bulk of my money is. That is where the bulk of Jeff Bezos's money is, though. If he wants to keep being a rich person, he actually needs all of us to have money to buy shit on Amazon.
Yes, exactly.
So I don't understand where the resistance is to this.
Yeah.
And don't even bother means testing it, because you know what's even more powerful than me having the money to buy my food is someone who doesn't need it having the money to buy a car or a computer that they don't need.
Right.
Rich people really make a lot of money off of people buying stupid shit they don't need. So, like, give everyone the money.
Yeah.
Including the people that don't need it. This is not the time to be means testing things, because that means a few people are going to fall through the cracks. And we can't afford to have a few people fall through the cracks. So don't even worry about it.
Yep.
Don't be responsible at all. Let people fraud the system. Who fucking cares? Right. The system is crazy.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway.
Oh, man. We mentioned a couple weeks ago there was some movement. You know, Sanders had introduced a plan to cut the Pentagon budget by 10%, and there was sort of another bill that Barbara Lee had introduced to cut it in half in the House, and it was all sort of a part of this big plan to have this go down next year when hopefully they would have the president and that stupid rule that didn't allow you to cut the Pentagon budget without cutting something, like some domestic, program the same amount is going to be gone next year. And it got the Sanders version of that, the 10% cut to the Pentagon budget, got an interesting endorsement this week and one that I wasn't expecting because it was Chuck Schumer, a man who has voted for every increase to the Pentagon budget that has been proposed by Trump.
Dawn of time.
Since the dawn of time.
Since the dawn of time. Because when I talked about getting rid of that hawkish Democrat bunch in New York, I am most specifically referring to Mr. Schumer.
Sure.
That's the ringleader of that bunch. So.
Yeah. But he said, I don't really like this wording, but I'm going to read it anyway because he said it. He said, "Proud I fought alongside Senator Sanders to ensure we vote in July on his amendment to cut $740 billion defense budget by 10% and put money into priorities like healthcare, housing, childcare, and minorities with 25% plus poverty, including many communities of color." That's what he said. And then he also said, I proudly support the amendment.
Yeah.
And like
this
I said,
is an amendment that the progressives are supporting. So that is unusual.
Yeah. There's a similar amendment in the House, which was, you know, sponsored by Pocan and Barbara Lee, Pramila Jayapal. So, you know, don't expect this to happen now and don't be disheartened if it doesn't, because this is a long game. This is meant to sort of educate. It's meant to sort of like get us all prepared for, you know, next January or the next time that we have to do a budget when the Democrats are in charge, hopefully, of every branch of government.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, glad to have Chuck on board.
Glad to have Chuck on board. I would like to hear if Joe Biden can be on board.
that would be
I would guess that the one Democrat who doesn't seem interested in having new ideas of late, because he's still, as we talked about in our task force special, which you should listen
to that.
Is Joe Biden. He's the one who I think is going to be the holdup once we have.
Could be.
If we end up with majorities in every House or in every chamber, what we're going to find is that Joe Biden is much more conservative than we thought.
Oh, I think so, too. The one thing that I will say about the defense budget anyway is that it has, like, fully doubled since he was the vice president. So I think on this front,
he might be.
He would be OK with it, because, like, on some level, like, if the budget was OK for the Pentagon while he was the vice president for 8 years and it's doubled, then it seems like he would be OK with Barbara Lee's plan to cut it in half. Sure. Now, I don't necessarily know that he's going to want to be the guy who cuts the Pentagon budget in half, because that doesn't seem like his story.
He's also a guy who voted for the Iraq War. But 10%,
I feel like 10% I think he'll get on board with.
I hope so. He's somebody who I think we often give him the credit of the ways in which Obama was forward thinking, even though he was literally brought on to be the guy who doesn't think those things.
Right.
You know, he's not Barack Obama. He voted for the Iraq War.
Yeah.
He is not somebody who was trying to have a more sensible foreign policy.
Right.
And Obama was. I mean, there's a lot of things I'm critical of the Obama administration for doing or not doing, but he was certainly offering a much more forward-thinking foreign policy than what we had then and have now.
Yep.
But that was not because Joe Biden was offering it with him.
Yeah. No.
In any case, in final news, Donald Trump has some competition in the crazy press conference campaign event category, because Kanye West held a campaign event that is rivaling all the campaign events.
Right, and let me tell you, I have some notes that I took here from literally just finding this on YouTube and popping around on it and stopping just in random parts. And every part that I stopped, I watched 5 minutes of it. It was 2 hours. And every single part that I stopped on was crazier than the last part that I stopped on. So I would highly recommend you watch this. It's crazy. He looked wild. He had 2020 shaved into his head. He was wearing like this military security vest.
Of course.
He was not in a mask. His microphone didn't work at the beginning of it. He was standing up on a stage shouting at people, maskless. And when I say shouting at people, I mean literally. He was shouting about how everybody has their demons. He was shouting about Jesus. He was shouting about Jews and Egyptians and various things.
Sure.
And then somebody from the crowd shouted about, what about the Gullah Geechee? Because he was in South Carolina. And then he said, you probably shouted at this guy. He was like, you probably went to Princeton. You're one of them. And then he had security escort that guy out of there. He literally just like picking fights with like people who were in the audience and like screaming at them. I mean, it was wild.
Very wild. I mean, here's the thing. One way maybe we can convince Donald Trump that he doesn't want to be the president anymore is if it starts to look like his events are not exciting enough. I mean, maybe this is a way we can use this Kanye situation to our advantage.
Maybe.
Because this sounds like a Trump event on steroids.
Totally.
And listen, we all enjoy some aspect of the Trump press conference experience and campaign speech experience. We don't like
to
admit that
to
ourselves. But he's an entertaining guy. And we know it. And you know it. We all know it. Even if we feel depressed that someone that entertaining is the president.
Right.
We know what we know. If Kanye West wants to take that crown from him as a non-credible candidate himself.
Right.
I feel like that actually helps us get farther down the road of this is just spectacle and has nothing to do with anything.
Yes.
That said, please don't vote for Kanye West for president.
No.
That is as bad, if not worse, than voting for Donald Trump. And look, I'm not going to say that it's worse, actually, because I don't know. They're both,
right.
That's giving Trump credit that he doesn't deserve.
Yeah, totally.
Because what
equally bad.
Kanye West is also a rich, successful businessman.
Yep.
You know, if you're going to give Trump the credit of being a successful businessman when he's patently not, then you have to give Kanye the same credibility. He's also rich via a business that he made himself rich in.
I was going to say, because he's at least talented.
That's right. That's like not something that Donald Trump has a talent, but I wouldn't call him talented. Whereas
right.
I think
correct.
Kanye West is talented in a way that's sort
talented.
Of tragic for him. He's a haunted, talented person.
Yes.
In any case, I don't feel like we can necessarily claim that one is more or less successful as a businessman.
No.
I think what we can say is that neither of them are qualified to be the president.
We can safely say that.
And I'm using a broad definition for qualified. I'm not using a non-broad. I don't mean qualified like I think you have to have been the Secretary of State to be the president. I mean just qualified in the most basic sense of having like a grasp on reality and like general sense of what's going on.
Right. Yes.
That said, let's make Donald Trump feel inadequate at the only thing he is adequate at.
Yes.
Which is putting on an entertaining...
Being the most entertaining guy in the room. Yep.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm with you.
Let's try something.
We got it.
We have to be more clever about Trump because he's not looking for the things that we think a person is looking for when it comes to being the president. You know, we have to find what he's looking for and take that from him. Not take the thing where... He cares if you think he's intelligent, but he doesn't care if you believe it. You know, like, he just cares that you tell him. Anyway.
No, it isn't.
That's the news this week. If you haven't listened to our Task Force special and want to find out, I think maybe that's why I'm so amped up about Joe Biden people not telling me I should just endorse him and move on.
Oh, right.
Because I think that there are some... That is what happened to the task force members.
Because he said that he wanted to, like, move up his, like, carbon date by 15 years. Like, now I'm supposed to just, like, suddenly, like, he did it now.
He hasn't yet made the threshold where I am enthusiastic about endorsing him. And I think he could. I believe in him and them enough to think that they could find a better way than Hillary Clinton found. And
They're off to a better start.
Exactly. I think they could find it. I don't think they're there yet. I don't think we should pretend they're there yet and throw in the towel and then be shocked when no one shows up to vote for him because he didn't offer anything anyone wanted.
Right.
Let's at least tell him what we want, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In any case, that's the news this week.
That's it.
We'll be back next week. And you'll hear more from us. See you then. Bye.